Well, coming up at 6:15 this evening, Tom Service presents Discovering Music, which today looks at Nielsen's Fourth Symphony. But now it's time for the first of today's proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, and it's introduced from the stage by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. I'm Catherine Bott, standing in for Sarah Moore Peach, who sadly is laid low with a nasty bug. If you're listening, Sarah, I hope you get well soon. We're live on BBC Radio 3, and ranged behind me on the stage of the Albert Hall this afternoon are 100 or so voices of the BBC Symphony Chorus. No stranger to the proms, of course, although they're most regularly heard with their instrumental partners, the BBC Symphony Orchestra. This afternoon, though, they're here in their own right, and we'll be hearing them in two major scores by the French composers Francis Poulenc and Daniel Lesueur. London Brass will be playing instrumental music by a Japanese composer whose music always had a thoroughly French flavour to it. That's Toru Takemitsu. And Chorus and Brass will be joined by the percussion ensemble O Duo for the world premiere of a piece commissioned for this afternoon's concert from the New York-born composer Stephen Montagu. He'll be joining me on stage later to tell us more about that. We begin with a piece that was conceived in wartime Paris by Francis Poulenc as his own personal act of resistance to the occupying Nazi forces, but which has since entered the musical pantheon as one of the major works of the 20th century. Figure Humaine, The Face of Humanity, is a 20-minute cantata of great virtuosity for unaccompanied voices, setting words by the poet Paul Éluard. Poulenc set them with the idea that the piece could be rehearsed in secret and then performed on the long-awaited day of liberation. Éluard's verses, in images sometimes surreal, sometimes nightmarish, vividly evoke the desperate world of occupied France, its savagery, hardships and sadness, but also its burning hope. And that hope is most powerfully uttered in the last movement, where Éluard's poem, matched by music which gradually increases in pace and excitement, describes the writing of a single word. A word which must be inscribed on school books and blank pages, in the sand and in the snow, on king's crowns and warriors' shields, on the night and on the day, on shattered dreams and on tender hopes. Inscribed on the hearts and lips of every loyal French person, young or old. And what is that word? We have to wait for Poulenc's final, unforgettable bars to hear it. It is liberté, liberty. And so to conduct Francis Poulenc's cantata for unaccompanied voices, Figure Humaine, please now welcome the director of the BBC Symphony Chorus, Stephen Jackson.
Thank you.
by the power of a word I begin my life anew. I was born to know you, to name you, Liberty. The unforgettable shout of hope which concludes Francis Poulenc's great wartime cantata for unaccompanied voices, Figure Humaine, set in the poems of Paul Éluard. We've heard it performed by the BBC Symphony Chorus, conducted by their director Stephen Jackson, and all praise to the voice at the very top, or maybe it was more than one, that the heroism which uttered that last note. I don't have perfect pitch, but I believe it's a top E. Splendid stuff from the ladies of the BBC Symphony Chorus. I mentioned earlier that Poulenc intended that the piece should be performed for the first time on the day that France was finally liberated from German occupation. In the event, the composer actually granted the premiere to the BBC in recognition of the support given to the French through the BBC's wartime broadcasts. So the very first performance of Figure Humaine was given in the Concert Hall of Broadcasting House on the 25th of March, 1945. Well, the BBC Symphony Chorus will return to 20th century French music for voices with the final piece in this afternoon's programme by Poulenc's contemporary Daniel Lesueur. But after the tour de force of choral virtuosity we've just heard, they're taking a well-deserved breather now while we turn to music for brass. The performers are London Brass, 10 players directed from the first trumpet by Andrew Crowley. In a big orchestral or choral ensemble like the BBC Symphony Chorus, the conductor's word is always law. But how does that work in a much smaller group, where there's no real conductor as such? Can democracy ever flourish in music? Here's London Brass's Andrew Crowley.
It's 10 players, and it is a pretty democratic sort of group. I mean, I obviously take responsibilities for, you know, getting everyone there and making sure that everything runs smoothly. And I probably take most of the responsibility for leading and directing. But within that, everyone has a say. And, you know, the physical way that it works is that we know each other incredibly well. The group's been together 24 years now. It's had a pretty good, steady membership. So you just need the odd little body movement or eye contact, and we know where to play, how to sort of perform together. So maybe I shouldn't say this. We don't spend as much rehearsing as maybe people would think. We play together regularly, and that seems to work for us. It doesn't take too much thinking about. It's surprisingly effortless.
Andrew Crowley, director of London Brass, who demonstrate now their collegial approach to music making in a piece by Toru Takemitsu. And if you think that music from 20th century Japan is going to be a bit of a gear shift after Poulenc, you're in for a surprise. Takemitsu's musical language is one that nods emphatically in the direction of Debussy, Ravel and Messiaen, as well as having its own distinctively Japanese sensibility. London Brass are going to play Garden Rain, which Takemitsu composed in 1974. 10 brass instruments are divided into two groups, and the title refers in part to the idea of the traditional Japanese garden, where the various component parts, water, plants, rocks, carefully raked gravel, are arranged so that they give constantly shifting and pleasing vistas designed to produce feelings of peace and harmony. It's a gentle, timeless contemplative piece, and the score is prefaced by lines from a poem by an 11-year-old Australian girl. Ours are the leaves of life, I am their gardener. Each hour falls down slow.
Thank you.
Garden Rain, a typically still, maybe even zen-like piece of musical contemplation by Toru Takemitsu. It was played there by London Brass, directed by Andrew Crowley. You can hear the French flavour there in Takemitsu's music, those luminous chords and beautifully imagined sonorities. Takemitsu says the piece should be played as slowly and softly as possible, which is a wonderful challenge in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, brass and chorus come together next in this afternoon's concert, and they're joined by a couple of percussionists for a new piece commissioned by the BBC Radio 3 from Stephen Montague. And I'm out on stage now at the Royal Albert Hall with Stephen to talk about it. Okay, Stephen, the leading questions are coming. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. After that very contemplative, inward-looking piece, we're going all out for extrovert music making, aren't we, with your piece? Your piece is called Willful Chance. I'm seeming to tell you about it. You already know that. You wrote it for large chorus, brass and percussion. And in the programme for this afternoon's concert, you describe it as, are you still standing by this, a setting of primitive ululations, spells of sorcery and pithy Latin words and phrases couched in ritual and wrapped in a shroud of synthetic liturgical cloth. So, Stephen, what does that say about your view of organized religion?
I think that maybe says it all. I grew up in the southern part of the United States in rural America in the 50s. My father was a choir director in choirs, and so I sang two services a day, a week, for most of my youth. And I'm afraid that rather turned me off from religion, so this is my revenge and my... My listening to the rants of preachers in the 50s is now my turn to rant in the Royal Albert Hall.
Well, I was listening to the rehearsal earlier this afternoon, and it's got a real incantatory quality to it. Where did you get all your many and varied texts from?
Well, the texts are all in Latin to make sure that nobody understood what was going on. So the idea is that you have an experience that if you don't have a program, you might enjoy it perhaps as just a piece of music that is engaging. If, however, you read the text, you'll realize it's anything but a religious experience. In fact, it's just the opposite. It begins with Karl Marx's favorite motto, which is doubt everything in Latin, de omnibus dubitatum. And it ends finally in sort of mock triumphant with the world wants to be deceived, so let it be. But there are many sort of, I would say, anti-ecclesiastical statements in and around the piece that are both pagan, sorceristic, etc. So it is a very kind of, I would say, anti-religions sort of view of things.
Well, it's full of what I might be allowed to call special effects for the singers after the virtuoso singing they just did in the Poulenc. It's an incredible challenge for them. And it's also got different mouthpieces used by the brass, percussion which goes up to and includes vibra-slap and tin cans. This is a BBC commission. Did you know when you started writing it that it was going to get its world premiere in this grand temple of music, the Royal Albert Hall?
Well, yes, I did know it was going to be in here. So it's a kind of religious experience here in the Royal Albert Hall to use vibra slaps, whips. In fact, one of the items that I use at the beginning and the end is the whip, which I think has a kind of flagellation quality that you find in some religions. So there are many elements here of my view of my rather jaundiced view of the church and religion. So. Yes, I did know it was going to be in this very sort of sacred hall, and it's a rather unsacred piece for it.
Stephen Montague, thank you very much. I'm going to let you negotiate your way back to your seat now. Let's have a round of applause for this pagan man. Well, doubt everything, said Karl Marx, but doubt not. This piece is wonderfully exciting and it's fun. Willful Chance, it's a continuous piece running for about 16 minutes, but one that navigates One navigating point to listen out for is the blood-curdling music we hear at the opening, a great ritualized mix of chanted yells and spells, the composer calls it, which comes back several times throughout the piece. This afternoon's program book contains a photo montage by Stephen's son Toby, which shows a wolf in a sheep's coat standing on a crusader's shield. That's making a good point. A witty visual image for a piece which Stephen Montagu says is a skeptical, socio-political, free word association rant, a wolf in ecclesiastical sheep's clothing. So to conduct the BBC Symphony Chorus, London Brass and the percussionist's O Duo in the world premiere of Stephen Montagu's Wilful Chants, please welcome Stephen Jackson. The world wants to be deceived, so let it be. The final words from Willful Chance. That was the world premiere of this piece, commissioned by BBC Radio 3 for the BBC Symphony Chorus and their director, Stephen Jackson, who's now taking a well-deserved bow. His conducting technique for this piece, absolutely fascinating, very characterful, but rather small gestures. He's obviously got the Symphony Chorus very well organised indeed, and they relished it too. Now here comes Stephen Montague, the composer. Negotiated his way back to his seat and back to the stage again. I think there's going to be a lot of handshaking. Stephen is obviously delighted with that performance. As you'll have heard from our little chat earlier on, like many serious musicians, he's got a wonderful sense of humour. He was born in New York State and studied in Florida, Ohio and Warsaw, but he's been in London since 1974. And his music's always had a bit of a transatlantic edge. His works include a concerto for piano, motorcycles and brass. Perhaps we'll hear that at the Proms one day. Here he is again to take a bow and to get everyone up. A generous composer. Nice to have a living composer on the stage. So as well as this piano, motorcycle and brass concerto, he's written a requiem, which includes parts for foghorns and pieces using wine glasses and a 2,000-year-old Celtic war horn. Montague and Jackson bowing together. Stephen Montague is currently a professor of composition at Trinity College of Music in London. Well, after raising the roof in Willful Chance, we return to the quiet, contemplative world of Toru Takemitsu next in this BBC Prom. London Brass are going to play two short fanfares composed in 1987 and given the title Signals from Heaven. Yes, I did say fanfares, they're traditional territory for brass instruments on grand occasions. But these, in typical Takemitsu vein, are probably the politest and most self-effacing brass fanfares you'll ever hear. In place of full-on declamation, Takemitsu substitutes liveliness and good humour. Each of the pieces has the instruments laid out in two small brass choirs, and a bit of a platform change is going on now. Ladies taking away chairs, moving music stands while the BBC Symphony Chorus sit down, I'm sure, very gratefully. Andrew Crowley, who's going to direct London Brass in this performance of the two fanfares, says that the way the groups will be set up is so that they can converse with each other, reminding him of the sort of instrumental writing you might find in a Gabriele Canzona from 17th century Venice. Which is interesting because London Brass, who in today's lineup are 14 men and one woman, that's trombonist Tracy Holloway, they're Proms veterans and they play brass repertoire going right from the early Venetian Baroque, the Gabrielis, etc., right through to, well, Bert Whistle, Turnage and Moondog, collaborations with Jack DeJohnette and John Sermon, the very, very enterprising brass ensemble. They don't just sit still. Now, this first fanfare of Takemitsu's is entitled Day Signal. It's lively and joyful, and the brass instruments are instructed to raise their bells in the air at the end to make the sound even more jubilant. After that, Night Signal, as you'd expect, is generally quieter and more peaceful. It's dedicated to the composer and conductor Oliver Nussen, a friend of Takemitsu's who's always been a great champion of his music. And now London Brass are returning to the platform to play these two antiphonal fanfares by Toru Takemitsu, Signals from Heaven. Here are London Brass, directed by Andrew Crowley. Night Signal and before it, Day Signal. Those two brass fanfares, signals from heaven, by the Japanese composer Toru Takemitsu, were performed by London Brass, directed by Andrew Crowley. Each antiphonal choir of London Brass taking a separate bow, being applauded from front by the audience and from behind by the ranks of the London Symphony, the BBC Symphony Chorus. Obviously, a very big appetite here at the Royal Albert Hall for a self-effacing fanfare or two. Well, this really has been the BBC Symphony Chorus's prom. They've risen to the challenge and they rightly take centre stage once again for the final work in this afternoon's concert, which takes us back to the nation and sound world which we heard at the very beginning. Poulenc's Figure Humaine of 1945 ends on a note of optimism, with the hope that its great final call for liberty will lead to a better, settled world. That it patently did so can be heard in the piece that ends this prom, composed only 7 years later and with an easy warmth and gentle sensuality which would have been unthinkable under the occupation. It's the Cantique des Cantiques, the Song of Songs by Daniel Lesueur, friend and contemporary of Messiaen, composer and general all-round good egg in post-war French music. The title of the piece gives away its source. These are settings of words taken from the biblical book known as the Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon, love poems by turn sweet, touching, gentle, and sometimes downright erotic between a bridegroom and his new wife. They are words which, although not originally intended as such, became co-opted into Jewish and Christian traditions as allegories for the love of God for humankind, and using the text's many idealized descriptions of female beauty as hymns in praise of the Virgin Mary. Daniel Lesueur sets 7 sections altogether in music which sometimes evokes ancient dances and songs, and which ends with an epithalamium, a wedding hymn, closing with ecstatic shouts of Alleluia. The piece is scored in lavish fashion, mostly in 12 parts, and using solo voices as well as the full chorus. This afternoon, those solo parts are taken by members of the Trinity College of Music Chamber Choir. You'll remember I said Stephen Montague is Professor of Composition there, and I should actually take the trouble to give the college its correct newish name, Trinity Laban Conservatory of Music and Dance, an inspired merger with stylish new headquarters in South London. So, to conduct the BBC Symphony Chorus and the soloists from Trinity in the Cantique des Cantiques by Daniel Lesueur, returning to the platform of the Royal Albert Hall now is Stephen Jackson.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cantique des Cantiques, words from the biblical Song of Songs, set to music for unaccompanied voices in 1952 by Daniel Lazur, who died just 8 years ago. We've just heard it sung by the BBC Symphony Chorus, with soloists drawn from the Trinity College of Music Chamber Choir and conducted by the Symphony Chorus's director, Stephen Jackson. He's allowing the choir just a brief sit down, but I don't think the audience will want to let them sit down for long. Stephen Jackson, he's a fine singer himself, you know. He might not admit it, but he's really knows how to bring out the best in other singers, and he's been doing that as director of the BBC Symphony Chorus for 21 years. He's also chorus master of the Trinity College of Music Chamber Choir, and those young 12 soloists from Trinity are now standing to be cheered by all their fellow singers. They made a very telling contribution. But as he gets the whole chorus up, I must say the power must go to the singers of the BBC Symphony Chorus, well deserving their solo turn at the proms. They're making 5 appearances in all this season. I think this could go on. Just to tell you that there's an all-instrumental prom this evening at 7:30. Andrew Davis, Louis Lochte and the BBC Symphony Orchestra with Messiaen, Mozart, Harry and Brahms, presented by Martin Handley. And do join me if you can for tomorrow's lunchtime proms chamber music recital of music by the Bach family. But for now, with the applause growing, I think it's back to Jill Anderson in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Catherine Bott. And you can hear that prom again for the next 7 days on the BBC iPlayer. Just go to bbc.co.uk/iPlayer. Well, next this afternoon is Discovering Music, which takes a look at Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable. Till then, Eric Parkin plays piano music by Poulenc. Eric Parkin played Poulenc's Nocturne No. 1 in C major. Well, looking ahead to 10 o'clock this evening, our Sunday feature is After a Dance Maker Dies. Following the deaths last year of dance visionaries Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch, Francis Burns speculates on whether modern dances can and should survive beyond the deaths of their creators. That's at 10 o'clock this evening. Now it's 5:45, time to join Tom Service for today's Discovering Music.
In 1917, a year after the premiere of Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, The Inextinguishable, had been given, the composer, Carl Nielsen, wrote to a friend of his. And this is what he said about the symphony. He said, "Its music is life. As soon as even a single note sounds in the air or through space, it is the result of life and movement. That is why music and dance are the most immediate expressions of the will to life. The symphony is not something with a thought content, except insofar as the structuring of the various sections and the ordering of the musical material are the fruit of deliberation by the composer, in the same way as when an engineer sets up dikes and sluices for the water during a flood. It is, in a way, a completely thoughtless expression of what makes the birds cry, the animals roar, bleat, run, and fight, and humans moan, groan, exult, and shout, without any explanation. The symphony does not describe all this, but the basic emotion that lies beneath all this. Music can do just this. It is its most profound quality, its true domain, because by simply being itself, it has performed its task. For music is life, whereas the other arts only represent and paraphrase life. Life is indomitable and inextinguishable. The struggle, the wrestling, the generation and the wasting away go on today as yesterday, tomorrow as today, and everything returns. Once more, music is life, and like it, inextinguishable." That's a pretty extraordinary opening to a symphony. You know, from the very first bar, we're thrust, all of us, right in the middle of something. Instead of there being a comforting opening idea or theme for us as listeners or the orchestra to get their hands and ears around, we're thrust into the middle of a conflict that's already happening. And this is a piece that was written in the middle of pretty well everything you can think of. It was composed between 1914 and 1916, and it is, definitively, a war symphony. Nielsen was very conscious of writing this piece in response to and with the First World War that was happening just south of him in Denmark at the time. He was also in the middle of big emotional turmoil in his own life. In 1914, he'd separated from his wife, a sculptor, and he was living on his own and trying to navigate his way in the world during the years that he's composing this piece. It's also in the middle of what's going on in music, in contemporary music at that time. Nielsen was very aware of what was happening in Germany, what Schoenberg was doing, what Stravinsky was doing, what Bartok was doing in Eastern Europe and in Paris as well. And this piece is absolutely his response to what music ought to be doing in 1916 and what the symphony ought to be. It's also in the middle of his career. This is the piece that, after its premiere, really cemented his reputation as the preeminent Danish composer and made him the most important composer, the most important musical figure in his homeland. The problem, though, is once you start a symphony like that, after that huge explosion of energy that seems to be sort of going in so many directions, is what you do next. How you structure a piece, how you harness that energy and make it coherent, as Nielsen does, for the next 40 minutes or so. Well, what he does is compose a four-movement symphony. Nothing unusual about that, in a certain sense. It starts with the allegro you've heard. There's then an allegretto, an adagio, and a final allegro. But all four movements are linked together, and all four have completely different musical characters. In the finale, you're going to hear a fight, a musical bust-up between the two timpanis, two timpani players, Mark and John behind me, and the rest of the orchestra. In the third movement, you're going to hear a searing lament that starts in the string section. And in the second movement, the allegretto, the poco allegretto, you're going to hear very odd kind of country dancing music. It's a very strange little movement. And then we have the rest of the first movement to deal with, which I want to deal with right now. I want to start, though, just by illustrating some of the elements that are already in motion, in conflict, in the excerpt we just heard. Let's just hear what the woodwinds play from the fifth bar. And this is what the strings are doing at roughly the same place. Similar music, but it's a very slightly different pitch. It's like a tone down. So what that means, the effect of that, is that you create dissonance. You create a sense of tension in the music. But that's not all that's going on. You also have the timpani hammering out this interval. That interval is a tritone. It's conventionally speaking, when we're thinking about music that's basically in a key, as a lot of this symphony is, it's the most dissonant interval you can manage. It's the distance between playing A and E flat, so three whole tones, which again produces this sense of unease, instability, motion, dynamism. However, having come up with that opening paragraph of music which rested on the solo cello, Nielsen now does something completely different, as we'll hear. It's a completely different kind of music, that, isn't it? It has a kind of a pastoral singing quality. It's in a different time signature. We're in beats of three rather than beats of two. And it also has, instead of that sense of instability, this is a different kind of motion. It's stable, this music. And in fact, when Nielsen wrote it, he wrote to a friend as he just composed this tune, this theme, he said, "I've also a subsidiary theme in the first movement. It runs in parallel thirds." It's the intervals that he's playing with there. "It runs in parallel thirds for some time. It's not quite like me, but it came out that way, so it's going to be like that all the same." So it suggests something about who Nielsen was as a composer, that he's someone who would let his inspiration run its course. And when he found himself alighting upon this tune, he thought, okay, this is what I'm going to work with. It suggests that even the act of composition for Nielsen is something dynamic, fluid, evolving, rather than pre-considered. Instead of filling out a structure, he's making this whole symphony bloom the way he wants it to, being led by it organically. However, this tune is also capable of being played differently and becoming something different. It has bigger potential even than what we've heard, and this is what happens next. So that huge climax brings us to the end of the first section of the first movement, in a place we haven't been before, a key we haven't been before. Now, I just want to talk briefly about this idea of tonality and key center. I promise this will be a relatively brief digression into music theory. But Nielsen is famous in his symphonies for coming up with something that we now call progressive tonality. It's one of those musicological words that sounds far more complicated than it actually is. It basically means you start in one key and you end in a different one. It's really no more complicated than that. So it means that instead of a symphony being in D minor and finishing in D minor, in this symphony we're moving from D minor and ending up, as it goes, in E major. The important thing, and the most important thing about this from our perspective as listeners and as players, is that Nielsen uses this tonal drama as one of the key sort of currents that's flowing through the veins of this symphony. It's one of the real energizing forces in this music. So just to illustrate how this is played out over the whole symphony, something of a little experiment I'm going to do with the BBC Philharmonic now. They're going to play a sequence of seven chords, which sums up in a pill the entire trajectory of Nielsen's Fourth Symphony. So this is a fast forward to the max. So let's just hear the first chord, D minor. A major. E major. G major. C sharp minor, A major again, and E major, finally. Thankfully, of course, that isn't all you need to hear to get the sense of what's going on in this symphony. But what you've just heard are the major key centres that we pass through. Now, the important thing to remember is that it's not what these things are, but it's the fact that Nielsen gives all of them a different emotional colour and character. And it's how that's communicated to us as listeners that drives us through the music as well. So we've reached, in our scheme, chord 2, from what you've just heard, A major. But as ever in this piece, Nielsen's nature and this music too really abhors a vacuum, you know? It abhors stasis. So he needs to move it on again. And this is how it does. This is our next example, please.